Behind this wainscot, it is true he can sense the tiny bones of mice. 100 generations. Their articulated forefeet folded in eternal rest. Their descendants, thriving, he can smell in the air. This is a job for Marlinspike, he says, if we can catch him. The cardinal's cat is feral now, ranging at will through London gardens, lured by the scent of carp from the ponds of city monasteries, tempted, for all he knows, across the river, to be snuggled to the bosoms of whores, slack breasts rubbed with rose petals and ambergris. He imagines Marlinspike lolling, purring, declining to come home again. He says to Christoph, I wonder how I can be master of the rolls if I'm not master of a cat. The rolls have not paused to go walking. Christoph is kicking a skirting. My foot go through it, he says, demonstrating. Will he leave the comforts of Austin Friars for the tiny windows with their warped panes, the creaking passages, the ancient draughts? It'll be a shorter journey to Westminster, he says. His aim is bent there. Whitehall, Westminster, and the river. Master Secretary's barge down to Greenwich, or up to Hampton Court. I shall be back at Austin Friars often, he says to himself, almost every day. He is building a treasure room, a repository secure for any gold plate the king entrusts to him. Whatever he deposits can quickly be turned into ready money. His treasure comes through the street on ordinary carts to attract no attention, though there are vigilant outriders. The chalices are fitted into soft leather cases made for them. The bowls and dishes travel in canvas bags, interleaved with white woolen cloth at 7 pence the yard. The jewels are swaddled in silk and packed into chests with new and shiny locks, and he has the keys. There are great pearls which gleam wet from the ocean, sapphires hot as India. There are jewels like the fruit you pick on a country afternoon, garnets like sloes, pink diamonds like rose hips. Alice says, For a handful of these I would myself overthrow any queen in Christendom. What a good thing the king hasn't met you, Alice. Joe says, I would as soon have it in export licenses or army contracts. Someone will make a fortune in the Irish wars. Beans, flour, malt, horse flesh. I shall see what I can do for you, he says. At Austin Friars he holds the lease for 99 years. His great-grandchildren will have it, some unknown Londoners. When they look at the documents, his name will be there. His arms will be carved over the doorways. He rests his hand on the banister of the great staircase, looks up into the dust-mote glitter from a high window. When did I do this? At Hatfield, early in the year, looking up, listening for the sounds of Morton's household long ago. If he himself went to Hatfield, must not Thomas More have gone up too? Perhaps it was his light footstep he expected overhead. He starts to think again about that fist that came out of nowhere. His first idea had been move clerks and papers to the rolls, then Austin Friars would become a home again. But for whom? He has taken out Liz's Book of Hours, and on the page where she kept the family listed, he has made alterations, additions. Rafe will be moving out soon to his new house in Hackney, and Richard is building in the same neighbourhood with his wife, Frances. Alice is marrying his ward, Thomas Rotherham. Her brother, Christopher, is ordained and beneficed. Joe's wedding clothes are ordered. She's snapped up by his friend John Aprice, a lawyer, a scholar, a man he admires, and on whose loyalty he counts. I have done well for my folk, he thinks. Not one of them poor, or unhappy, or uncertain of their place in this uncertain world. He hesitates, looking up into the light. Now gold, now blue as a cloud passes. Whoever will come downstairs and claim him must do it now. His daughter Anne, with her thundering feet. Anne, he would say to her, couldn't we have felt mufflers over those hooves of yours? Grace, skimming down like dust, drawn into a spiral, a lively swirl, going nowhere, dispersing, gone. Liz, come down. But Liz keeps her silence. She neither stays nor goes. She is always with him and not with him. He turns away. So this house will become a place of business, as all his houses will become places of business. My home will be where my clerks and files are. Otherwise, my home will be with the king, where he is. Christophe says,
Now we are removed to the Rolls-House. I can tell you, cher maître, how I am happy that you did not leave me behind, for in your absence they would call me snail-brain and turniped.
Alors, he takes a view of Christophe, your head is indeed like a turnip. Thank you for attracting my attention to it. Installed at the Rolls, he takes a view of his situation. Satisfactory. He has sold off his 2 Kent manors, but the king has given him 1 in Monmouthshire, and he's buying another in Essex. He has his eye on plots in Hackney and Shoreditch, and is taking in leases on the properties around Austin Friars, which he intends to enfold in his building plans, and then build a big wall around the lot. He has surveys to hand of a manor in Bedfordshire, 1 in Lincolnshire, and 2 Essex properties he intends to put in trust for Gregory. All this is small stuff. It's nothing to what he intends to have, or to what Henry will owe him. Meanwhile, his outgoings would frighten a lesser man. If the king wants something done, you have to be able to staff the enterprise and fund it. It is hard to keep up with the spending of his noble councillors, and yet there are a crew of them who live at the pawn shop, and come to him month by month to patch the holes in their accounts. He knows when to let these debts run. There is more than 1 kind of currency in England. What he senses is a great net is spreading about him, a web of favours done and favours received. Those who want access to the king expect to pay for it, and no one has better access than he. And at the same time, the word is out. Help Cromwell, and he will help you. Be loyal, be diligent, be intelligent on his behalf. You will come into a reward. Those who commit their service to him will be promoted and protected. He is a good friend and master. This is said of him everywhere. Otherwise, it is the usual abuse. His father was a blacksmith, a crooked brewer. He was an Irishman. He was a criminal. He was a Jew. And he himself was just a wool trader. He was a shearsman, and now he is a sorcerer. How else but by being a sorcerer would he get the reins of power in his hand? Chapuis writes the Emperor about him. His early life remains a mystery, but he is excellent company, and he keeps his household and retainers in magnificent style. He is a master of language, Chapuis writes, a man of most eloquent address, though his French, he adds, is only assez bien. He thinks it's good enough for you. A nod and a wink will do for you. These last months, the council has never been out of harness. A hard summer of negotiating has brought a treaty with the Scots, but Ireland is in revolt. Only Dublin Castle itself and the town of Waterford hold out for the king, while the rebel lords are offering their services and their harbours to the Emperor's troops. Among these isles it is the most wretched of territories, which does not pay the king what it costs him to garrison it. But he cannot turn his back on it, for fear of who else might come in. Law is barely respected there, for the Irish think you can buy off murder with money, and like the Welsh, they cost out a man's life in cattle. The people are kept poor by imposts and seizures, by forfeitures and plain daylight robbery. The pious English abstain from meat on Wednesdays and Fridays, but the joke runs that the Irish are so godly, they abstain every other day as well. Their great lords are brutal and imperious men, treacherous and fickle, inveterate feuders, extortionists and hostage-takers. And their allegiance to England they hold cheap, for they are loyal to nothing and prefer force of arms to law. As for the native chiefs, they recognise no natural limit to their claims. They say that on their land they own every ferny slope and lake, they own the heather, the meadow grass, and the winds that riffle it. They own every beast and every man, and in times of scarcity they take the bread to feed their hunting dogs. No wonder they don't want to be English. It would interrupt their status as slave owners. The Duke of Norfolk still has serfs on his land. and even if the law courts move to free them, the Duke expects a fee from it. The King proposes to send Norfolk to Ireland, but he says he's spent enough futile months over there, and the only way he'll go back is if they build a bridge so he can get home at the end of the week without getting his feet wet. He and Norfolk fight in the council chamber. The Duke rants, and he sits back and folds his arms and watches him ranting. "You should have sent young Fitzroy to Dublin," he tells the council. "An apprentice king. Make a show, stage a spectacle, throw some money about." Richard says to him, "Perhaps we should go to Ireland, sir." "I think my campaigning days are over. I would like to be in arms. Every man should be a soldier once in his life." "That is your grandfather speaking through you. Ap Evans, the archer. Concentrate for now on making a show in the tournaments." Richard has proved a formidable man in the lists. It is more or less, as Christoph says, biff, and they are flat. You would think the sport was in his nephew's blood, as it is in the blood of the lords who compete. He carries the Cromwell colours, and the King loves him for it, as he loves any man with flair and courage and physical strength. Increasingly, his bad leg forces him to sit with the spectators. When he is in pain, he is panicked. You can see it in his eyes. And when he is recovering, he is restless. Uncertainty about his own state of health makes him less inclined for the expense and trouble of organizing a large tournament. When he does run a course with his experience, his weight and height, his superb horses and the steel of his temperament, he is likely to win. But to avoid accidents, he prefers to run against opponents he knows. Henry says, "The Emperor, 2 or 3 years back when he was in Germany, did he not have an evil humour in his thigh? They say the weather didn't suit him, but then his dominions offer a change of climate, whereas from one part of my kingdom to the next there is no change to be found. Oh, I expect it's worse in Dublin." Henry looks out, hopeless at the teeming rain. "And when I ride out, the people shout at me. They rise up out of ditches and shout about Catherine, how I should take her back. How would they like if I told them how to order their houses and wives and children?" Even when the weather clears, the King's fears do not diminish. "She will escape and raise an army against me," he says. "Catherine, you do not know what she would do. She told me she would not run. And you think she never lies? I know she lies. I have proof of it. She lied about her own virginity." "Oh, that," he thinks tiredly. It seems Henry doesn't believe in the power of armed guards in locks and keys. He thinks an angel recruited by the Emperor Charles will make them fall away. When he travels, he takes with him a great iron lock, which is affixed to his chamber door by a servant who goes with him for the purpose. His food is tasted for poison, and his bed examined, last thing at night, for concealed weapons such as needles. But even so, he is afraid he will be murdered as he sleeps. Autumn. Thomas More is losing weight, a wiry little man emerging from what was never a superfluity of flesh. He lets Antonia Bonvisi send him food in. "Not that you Lucchese know how to eat. I'll send it myself. But if he took ill, you know what people would say. He likes dishes of eggs. I don't know if he likes much else." A sigh. "A milk puddings?" He smiles. "These are carnivorous days. No wonder he doesn't thrive." "I have known him for 40 years, Bonvisi says. "A lifetime, Tommaso. You wouldn't hurt him, would you? Please assure me, if you can, that no one will hurt him."
"Why do you think I'm no better than he is? Look, I have no need to put him under pressure. His family and friends will do it, won't they?"
"Can't you just leave him there, forget him?"
"Of course, if the King allows."
He arranges for Meg Roper to visit. Father and daughter walk in the gardens, arm in arm. Sometimes he watches them from a window in the Lord Lieutenant's lodgings. By November, this policy has failed. Turned back, really, and bitten his hand, like a dog that out of kindness you pick up in the street. Meg says, "He has told me and he has asked me to tell his friends that he will have no more to do with oaths of any kind, and that if we hear he has sworn, we are to take it that he has been forced by ill usage and rough handling. And if a paper is shown to the council with his signature on it, we are to understand it is not his hand. More is now required to swear to the Act of Supremacy, an act which draws together all the powers and dignities assumed by the king in the last 2 years. It doesn't, as some say, make the king head of the church. It states that he is head of the church and always has been. If people don't like new ideas, let them have old ones. If they want precedence, he has precedence. A second enactment, which will come into force in the new year, defines the scope of treason. It will be a treasonable offence to deny Henry's titles or jurisdiction, to speak or write maliciously against him, to call him a heretic or a schismatic. This law will catch the friars who spread panic and say the Spanish are landing with the next tide to seize the throne for the Lady Mary. It will catch the priests who in their sermons rant against the king's authority and say he is dragging his subjects after him to hell. Is it much for a monarch to ask that a subject keep a civil tongue in his head? This is new, people say to him, this treason by words, and he says no, be assured, it is old. It casts into statute law what the judges in their wisdom have already defined as common law. It is a measure for clarification. I am all for clarity. Upon More's refusal of this second oath, a bill is brought in against him, forfeiting his goods to the crown. He now has no hope of release, or rather the hope lies in himself. It is his duty to visit him, tell him he will no longer be allowed visitors or strolls in the garden. Nothing to see this time of year. More casts a glance at the sky, a narrow strip of grey through the high window. I can still have my books, write letters. For now. And John Wood, he stays with me. His servant. Yes, of course. He brings me a little news from time to time. They say the sweating sickness has broken out among the king's troops in Ireland, so late in the year, too. Plague has also broken out. He's not going to tell more that, or that the whole Irish campaign is a debacle, and a money sink, and that he wishes he had done as Richard said and gone out there himself. The sweat takes off so many, More says, and so swiftly, and in their prime, too. And if you survive it, you are in no condition to fight the wild Irish, that's for sure. I remember when Meg took it, she nearly died. Have you had it? No. You're never ill, are you? He is chattering pointlessly, then he looks up. Tell me, what do you hear from Antwerp? They say Tyndale is there. They say he lives straitly. He dare not stray beyond the English merchant's house. They say he is in prison, almost as I am. It is true, or partly true. Tyndale has laboured in poverty and obscurity, and now his world has shrunk to a little room. While outside in the city, under the Emperor's laws, printers are branded and have their eyes put out, and brothers and sisters are killed for their faith, the men beheaded, the women buried alive. More has a sticky web in Europe still, a web made of money. It is his belief that his men have followed Tyndale these many months, but all his ingenuity, and Stephen Vaughan's on the spot, have not been able to find out which of the Englishmen who pass through that busy town are More's agents. Tyndale will be safer in London, More says, under yourself, the protector of error. Now, look at Germany today. You see, Thomas, where heresy leads us. It leads us to Munster, does it not? Sectaries, Anabaptists have taken over the city of Munster. Your worst nightmares, when you wake paralysed and think you have died, are bliss compared with this. The burgomasters have been ejected from the council, and thieves and lunatics have taken their places, proclaiming that the end times have come, and all must be rebaptized.
Citizens who dissent have been driven beyond the walls, naked to perish in the snow. Now the city is under siege from its own Prince Bishop, who intends to starve it out. The defenders, they say, are for the most part the women and children left behind. They are held in dread by a tailor called Bockelson, who has crowned himself King of Jerusalem. It is rumoured that Bockelson's friends have instituted polygamy, as recommended in the Old Testament, and that some of the women have been hanged or drowned rather than submit to rape under cover of Abraham's law. These prophets engage in daylight robbery, in the name of holding goods in common. It is said they have seized the houses of the rich, burned their letters, slashed their pictures, mopped the floors with fine embroidery, and shredded the records of who owns what, so former times can never come back. Utopia, he says, is it not? I hear they are burning the books from the city libraries. Erasmus has gone into the flames. What kind of devils would burn the gentle Erasmus? But no doubt, no doubt, Moore nods, Munster will be restored to order. Philip, the Prince of Hesse, Luther's friend, I have no doubt he will lend the good bishop his cannon and his cannoneers, and one heretic will put down another. The brethren fall to scrapping, do you see? Like rabid dogs drooling in the streets, who tear out each other's entrails when they meet. I tell you how Munster will end. Someone inside the city will surrender it. You think so? You look as if you would offer me odds. But there, I was never much of a gambler. And now the king has all my money. A man like that, a tailor, jumps up for a month or two. A wool merchant, a blacksmith's son. He jumps up for a year or two. He stands, picks up his cape. Black wool, lambskin lining. Moore's eyes gleam. Ah, look, I have you on the run. Now he murmurs, as if it were a supper party, must you go? Stay a little, can't you? He lifts his chin. So, I shall not see Meg again. The man's tone, the emptiness, the loss, it goes straight to his heart. He turns away to keep his reply calm and trite. You have to say some words, that's all. Ah, just words. And if you don't want to say them, I can put them to you in writing. Sign your name and the king will be happy. I will send my barge to row you back to Chelsea and tie up at the wharf at the end of your own garden. Not much to see, as you say, at this time of year. But think of the warm welcome within. Dame Alice is waiting. Alice is cooking well. That alone would restore you. She is standing by your side, watching you chew. And the minute you wipe your mouth, she picks you up in her arms and kisses away the mutton fat. Why, husband, I have missed you. She bears you off to her bedchamber, locks the door and drops the key in her pocket, and pulls off your clothes till there you are in your shirt and nothing but your little white legs sticking out. Well, admit it, the woman is within her rights. The next day, think of it, you rise before dawn, shuffle to your familiar cell and flog yourself, call for your bread and water, and by 8 o'clock back in your hair shirt, and over it your old woolen gown, that blood-coloured one with a rent in it, feet up on a stool, and your only son bringing in your letters, snapping the seal on your darling Erasmus. Then, when you've read your letters, you can hobble out, let's say it's a sunny day, and look at your caged birds, and your little fox in its pen, and you can say, I was a prisoner too, but no more because Cromwell showed me I could be free. Don't you want it? Don't you want to come out of this place? You should write a play, Moore says wonderingly. He laughs. Perhaps I shall. It's better than Chaucer. Words, words, just words. He turns, he stares at Moore. It's as if the light has changed. A window has opened on a strange country where a cold wind from childhood blows. That book, was it a dictionary? Moore frowns. I'm sorry. I came up the stairs at Lambeth. Give me a moment. I came running up the stairs, carrying your measure of small beer and your wheaten loaf, to keep you from being hungry if you woke in the night. It was 7 in the evening. You were reading, and when you looked up, you held your hands over the book. He makes the shape of wings, as if you were protecting it. I asked you, Master Moore, what is in that great book? You said words. Words, just words. Moore tilts his head. This was when? I believe I was 7. Oh, nonsense, Moore says genially. I didn't know you when you were 7. Why, you were, he frowns. You must have been, and I was, about to go to Oxford. You don't remember. But why would you? He shrugs. I thought you were laughing at me. Oh, very probably I was, Moore says, if indeed such a meeting took place. Now witness these present days, when you come here and laugh at me, talking about Alice and my little white legs. I think it must have been a dictionary. You're sure you don't remember? Well, my barge is waiting, and I don't want to keep the oars out in the cold. The days are very long in here, Moore says. The nights are longer. My chest is bad. My breathing is tight. Back to Chelsea, then. Dr. Butts will visit. Tut-tut, Thomas Moore. What have you been doing to yourself? Hold your nose and drink off this foul mixture. Sometimes I think I shall not see morning. He opens the door. Martin? Martin is 30, wiry, his fair hair under his cap already sparse. Pleasant face with a crinkly smile. His native town is Colchester, his father a tailor, and he learned to read on Wycliffe's Gospel, which his father hid in their roof under the thatch. This is a new England, an England where Martin can dust the old text down and show it to his neighbours. He has brothers, all of them Bible men. His wife is just now confined with her third child. Crawled into the straw, as he puts it. Any news? Not yet. But will you stand godfather? Thomas, if it's a boy, or if it's a girl, you name her, sir. A touch of palms and a smile. Grace, he says. A money gift is understood. The child's start in life. He turns back to the sick man, who now slumps over his table. Sir Thomas says at night his breath comes short. Bring him some bolsters, cushions, whatever you can find. Prop him up to ease him. I want him to have every opportunity to live, to rethink his position, show loyalty to our king, and go home. And now, bid you both good afternoon. Moore looks up. I want to write a letter. Of course. You shall have ink and paper. I want to write to Meg. Then send her a human word. Moore's letters are beyond the human. They may be addressed to his daughter, but they are written for his friends in Europe to read. Cromwell? Moore's voice calls him back. How is the Queen? Moore is always correct. Not like those who slip up and say Queen Catherine. How is Anne, he means. But what could he tell him? He's on his way. He's out of the door. In the narrow window, a blue dusk has replaced the grey. He had heard her voice from the next room. Low, relentless. Henry yelping in indignation. Not me! Not me! In the antechamber, Thomas Boleyn, Monseigneur, his narrow face rigid. Some Boleyn hangers-on, exchanging glances. Francis Weston, Francis Bryan. In a corner, trying to make himself inconspicuous, the lutenist Mark Smeaton. What's he doing here? Not quite a family conclave. George Boleyn is in Paris, holding talks. An idea has been floated that the infant Elizabeth should marry a son of France. The Boleyns really think this is going to happen. Whatever can have occurred, he says, to upset the Queen. His tone is astonished, as if she were the most placid of women. Weston says, It's Lady Carey, she is... That is to say, she finds herself... Brian snorts. With a belly full of bastard.
Ah, didn't you know? The shock around him is gratifying. He shrugs. I thought it a family matter.